significant spike in lung cancer on Earth. And in the wake of the SNAP 9A, the satellites, all our satellites now are solar powered. The International Space Station is solar powered. But we would develop this Star Wars program using nuclear because of the extremely high energy needs of these terrible weapons that are proposed. It's going backwards, right, in terms of what we know now, and the madness has to stop.
Well, Carl, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insight with us. We'll post a link to your article as well as the website that you mentioned on our site. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
My guest is Carl Grossman, a professor of journalism at State University of New York, and he has been writing about Space Force. We'll link to a couple of articles that he just published online about the issue. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Up next is Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland's Folk Festival on Friday, January 10th and Saturday, January 11th, 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Portland's Folk Festival is an all-ages celebration of folk and Americana music in Portland. Friday performers include Anna Tibble, Cedar Teeth, Glitter Fox, and more. Saturday performers include Horse Feathers, The Get Ahead, and more. Again, that's Portland's Folk Festival, Friday, January 10th, and Saturday, January 11th. From 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
When we meet, there won't be winter.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland's Folk Festival on Friday, January 10th and Saturday, January 11th, 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Portland's Folk Festival is an all-ages celebration.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Lane Ponce, your fifth Monday host on Labor Radio. This evening, we have guest star and often participant on my show, Susan Stoner, and she's going to be talking about her most recent book on a series that she's been working on for several years. Susan, welcome, and give me a rundown on your new book, the name of it, and what you think the topic is that we'd be interested in.
The name of the book is Bitter Cry, and it's about how progressives in Portland address the issue of child labor in the early 1900s. And it mirrors what happened across the country, where people were trying to stop child labor and were addressing child labor and child poverty. It was out of the Gilded Age and the Depression of the 1890s. People became appalled at what was happening, and there were some real significant moves that they made at that time. So it all sounds kind of dull, but actually it's a mystery adventure story, lots of action and excitement in it. I like to make it an easy, almost beach read, that at the end you go, oh, I just learned a whole bunch of history about Portland and the Pacific Northwest and the country that I didn't know. So,
and your the particular period you work around in Portland is what?
It's the early 1900s, sort of when the progressive era, the country's first progressive era was underway. And by progressive, it's where you put, they dressed things like economic and social justice issues. And in many ways, it mirrors today because there was gross income inequality. And they people just finally got fed up with it and rose up, ordinary people, and they changed the country. Unfortunately, we're having to fight many of the same battles again, including child labor battles. The Koch brothers, of course, one of them has since died, but that duo there, and their ALEC, which is their organization that proposes legislation, actually has been proposing and has a blueprint of how to roll back all the child labor protections. And you'll hear every once in a while the right wing talking about, oh, it's good for kids to work and things like that. And that's where that's coming from, is from the Koch brothers and the right wing.
Because they work for less?
They work for less. Definitely they work for less. And even today, I mean, we have a problem in that the children working in agriculture and in tobacco in particular, they don't have the protections that other children do. And so there's a real problem with nicotine poisoning of children in the tobacco fields in the United States right now. And then, of course, there's also the problem that a lot of our electronics and other things are the result of child labor elsewhere in the world. And so it's still a big problem.
We don't see it as much if it's elsewhere, though, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. In your research, what did you find was going on specifically in Portland? What was the area of child labor that you discovered?
Well, I focused on three. Basically, well, I focused on child poverty because there was a lot of poverty of children in Portland. The North End, fully 30% of the children were undernourished. And so I focused on child poverty. I focused on newspaper boys and our newspaper kids, because sometimes girls were doing it, and also on messenger kids, and then on childminder kids, because as the poor parents went out to work, they'd have small children and somebody had to take care of them. So oftentimes it would be a young girl of maybe 8 or 9 taking care of infants. So those were kind of the four that I looked at.
So this is an ongoing series, and it features, what's the guy's name?
Sage Adair.
A very poetic name. Give me a little background on Sage Adair and his involvement in progressive ideas and actions.
He grew up in Appalachia, and his parents worked in the mines, and he worked in the mines until he was 9. He was a breaker boy. And then he went, as soon as he turned, that was before he was 9. He started when he was 7. And then when he went into the mines, he was the kid that they used to dig out underneath the wall of the coal, a very thin place for him to slither in and plant dynamite, sticks of dynamite, to bring down the wall. And that's how children were used there, in one of the ways they were used. So he was in there doing that when there was an explosion in the mine, which was common in those days. And he lived. And the mine owner's son was killed, but his grandson, Sage, managed to save. And as a consequence, he got adopted by the mine owner, and raised in basically a wealthy environment, although the mine owner never really liked, he always resented the fact that Sage lived and his son died. So then from there, he went to the Klondike and got rich because he got to the Klondike. He went off to adventure once he got through college and ended up then coming back, finding his mother, and dedicating himself to the labor movement. And he and his mother both were involved in the labor movement in Appalachia and then in New Orleans, and then they came to the Pacific Northwest to Portland, where he runs a fancy restaurant and engages in undercover labor movement work.
His cover story is he's a wealthy restaurant owner.
Yes.
And he can eavesdrop on all the wealthy people in Portland because they hang out at his restaurant.
Yes, and invite him to things because he and his own, you know, he is wealthy himself, at least appears wealthy to them. So.
Well, and he did make quite a bit of money in the gold fields, right?
Yes. Yes, he
but
did.
But he takes his money to do good.
Yes.
Yes. And also there's, what's that, the secret-y guy from back east that's always sending him little projects to work on?
Oh.
Albine?
Yeah, that's, I call him Vincent St. John, and he's based on a real labor leader back in the day who was called the Saint, and people called him that because... he was a kind man, and he also went into a mine that had collapsed to save a number of miners, and in the course of it, he actually lost his arm. And anyway, he was very highly thought of. And
that's a real character.
That's a real person.
A real person.
I use real people, mm-hmm. The good ones anyway. in the Bitter Cry, the most recent one, I was amazed to discover a woman named Millie Trumbull. And really, after learning about her, I really think that we need a statue or a street named after her, because she was on the boards of at least 15 to 20 nonprofits at the time that were attempting to make the world a better place. Most of it had to do with children, but also TB hospital and things like that. And she, her whole life was dedicated to these organizations, where she not only sat on the board, but she was the secretary, which meant she wrote all the letters, she did most of the reports and the speeches. And a lot of the organizations that she was on, Boys and Girls Society, things like that, the men got the credit. But the women were doing the work, and that, you know, and
that sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah, but I didn't really expect to find that. You know,
yeah.
I guess I'm naive. And
now, did
so,
you use her as a character in the book, or did you?
She is a character in the book.
Okay.
And another woman that is a woman called Valentine Pritchard, and she came to Portland to be a kindergarten teacher, and she ended up being the first director of the People's Institute, which was a settlement house in the North End. That was very crucial and was actually the beginning of the University of Oregon Medical School's clinic for poor people. And they used to have a large clinic for that up until, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago. I don't think they run it anymore, but I could be wrong about that.
And this was, again, back in 1910?
Yeah, early 1900s, actually 1903. So far I'm only up to 1904.
1904?
Yeah.
Your character is progressing through that early century.
Very slowly.
Well, what I was interested in, and let's say that name of the book again, her most recent one is called Bitter Cry, A Sage Adair Historical Mystery by S.L. Stoner. Have you been doing engagements at Powell's and other places yet?
Yes, I'm going to be at Powell's on Hawthorne on the 16th. That's sort of my favorite go-to place. I've done all my books there, and I really love to see people come, and I make cookies.
Bitter cookies?
No, they'll be good cookies.
And now I noticed in this book, because this is the eighth book,
yes.
You have a particular style on the covers, the artwork on the covers.
Yes.
This one seems to be a little different than the
really?
Others. Well, the style's the same, but did someone else do the work in somebody else's style?
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, I have a friend, I have somebody who does the layout for me, and I asked him, I said, unfortunately, the originator of the style is an artist named Alec Icky Dunn. He's here in Portland. He's now an RN at Emmanuel. Immensely talented. He also plays in a band and does other kinds of artwork, lots of CD covers and things like that. I really recommend him. He's really a talented fellow. But he wanted to get out of the book cover business, and so my friend suggested this other person, and that he showed me his catalog of work that he'd done, and he could do it. And it was easy. It worked really nice.
Yeah, I just noticed that because you had quite a write-up in the front of the book about what used to be and what was now. So
yeah.
It caught my eye.
Yeah, well, I wanted to give credit to Icky for the style because it's Icky's style.
Mm-hmm. It's very distinct, and my collection of 8 mystery novels all have the same little guy on the back. That's Adair Sage with his mustache and his... Is that a bowler? Is that what you call that hat?
No, that's not a bowler. I'm not sure what that one is.
I don't know.
No, that's not a bowler.
But it definitely looks turn-of-the-century style.
Yes.
Well, you said he met up with his... Now, these are fictional characters, again. But Sage Adair meets up with his mother. How did that happen, and what was the backstory with that meeting up?
Well, the meeting up I've never discussed in a book. So he just went hunting for her, I guess, because... he was with her until he was 9, mm-hmm. So he knew her. But they were his father had worked with the Pinkertons to betray the Union people, and had gotten her father and one of her brothers killed. And as a consequence, she basically split from him. And so Sage was raised by his mother and his uncle. His uncle also worked in the mine and actually died of black lung. And so they were really poor in Appalachia in the mining. It was really tough times for people. And so when the mine owner said, I'll take your kid and I'll raise him, I'll educate him, and I'll give him a life you can never give, she went along with it. And very sorrowfully and very sadly. But she's a very tough lady and an admirable woman. And when they've got together, they belong to each other.
And they don't always let people know they're mother and son, right?
No.
In fact, that's kind of one of the big secrets with his restaurant.
Yes, because she works there sort of as the person that kind of keeps it all running. But she doesn't... they don't want to announce it because it was a tough time. There was a lot of things like the Pinkertons, and it was a tough time for Union people. It was a dangerous time for them, so they kind of keep that under their hats.
Well, so far I've really enjoyed reading all of these books because I found out about the bridges across the gulches in Portland. I don't, we drive across them and don't even think anything about it now. But in the early days, they were quite dangerous and all over the place.
Yeah, there was over 60.
Yeah.
Across gulches, not across the river, but
right.
Across gulches, yeah.
And until I read that, I wasn't even, the topography of Portland, it seems flat to me because I'm driving, it's flat. But yeah, that was really an interesting part. And then, there's been so many other things that you've brought up. What, name a few for me and I'll remember them.
Well, when I did Timber Beast, that was about the timber fraud that ended up with a senator and the U.S. district attorney going to prison or getting convicted of timber fraud.
True story.
Yes, true story. Shanghai was addressed in Land Sharks. Land Sharks was really interesting to me because I had no idea what the economics was, and that Shanghai actually was of great benefit to the merchants and people in Portland, and we were the Shanghai capital.
And that was when people were being stolen off the street, getting them drunk, stealing them, and putting them on ships to
exactly.
work.
Exactly, and a lot of them died.
And the tunnels are still there, some
yes.
of them, right?
Some, the remnants of them
over
are there.
On Northwest, because the ones that were in Southwest, all the high rises dropped right through them when they were putting in their. Foundations.
Yeah.
But there is, I think there's a tour over in that part of Portland.
There is, yes. It's a small tour, but it's, if you have an imagination, it's worth it. Although, be sure and carry a death's mask for your face, because the dirt down there has been there for over 100 years, and it's, who knows what kind of germs are in there. People used to, Chinese would put their dead and dying down in there because if there was an illness that swept through and they died, they were afraid they would get thrown out of the country because a lot of them were here illegal, came up maybe through Mexico and stuff. So they things like TB was rampant, and so I really caution people to wear a dust mask if you go to that. But it's entertaining and interesting, and the guide that I went with was very knowledgeable.
Yeah, so. And there was kind of an underground village of Chinese workers in that area, right?
Although if you want to see the best one, oddly enough, the best underground Chinese tour is in Pendleton, Oregon.
Oh, I know that. Yeah, I did. So I was trained in Pendleton for several weeks, and I heard about it. I did not go on it, but I was aware that it was there.
It beats Seattle. It beats Portland. It's excellent. It's very, very good.
And the remnants of that era sometimes is still around in Chinese restaurants. The old-time non-gourmet Chinese restaurants that are still around in Eastern Oregon and around.
And you would know that better than me coming from there.
Yes, because I was there for several months and Chinese food was good.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I noticed about your books and enjoyed is in the back you do a lot of notes about what's actual and what's fictional and the blending of the two. So that leads me to believe that you do a lot of research on the works that you do.
Yeah.
How do you do that? What's your process?
Oh, boy. It depends on the subject. The Shanghai one, I went to San Francisco to the Maritime Museum because they had a lot of information on Shanghai. For the Teddy Roosevelt one, which is called Black Drop, and that one I actually researched at the Congressional Library in Washington, D.C. The one that I'm researching now, I'm going to travel up to Seattle to the U.S. Government Archives. So it just depends on the topic. For the Bitter Cry, I did a research at the Portland Archives. And I also went to the State Archives and the State Library, trying to sort of pin down what happened with child labor and what the sequence of events was. And it was in 1902 that they actually had the first law that set a minimum age that kids could work, 14, and also it set some standards about what kind of work they could do. And that was in 1902, 1903 is when that happened.
Now, to back up a little bit, you said that your book about Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes.
That was interesting because it was an attempted assassination that you found information about. Tell me more about that.
Well, that one was, I decided I was going to have an assassination. He came to visit Portland. It was a big to-do, biggest parade we've ever had. And he was going to give a speech, and I tried to think, okay, well, if I'm going to make him, the plot of the assassination is kind of the heart of the story, where would I have that happen at? So I figured out where his route was and all that, and I decided it would be at what at that time was called City Park, which is now Washington Park. And as you drive up the main road from downtown, you'll see there's an obelisk there. And that was, he did the cornerstone for that obelisk. That was the big hoo-ha, and the governor was there and everybody, and they buried a time capsule, and he did that part. And then he gave a speech. So I thought, well, I'll do it there. Well, it was only after I'd written the book I discovered that, lo and behold, somebody had, they arrested somebody for making an attempt to assassinate him at the time. Then they found out later he was just kind of a crazy guy and had a strange object that they thought was a bomb or a gun, but it turned out it wasn't. He was just trying to get the president's attention.
So it came after you had finished up your book and your research. And yeah.
And that happens a lot when I did Dry Rot, which is about the bridges falling down. And one in December of 1902, all these ravine bridges started collapsing. And in that, sort of it's the focus is a strike that the carpenters who did those bridges and other things in the city were on strike because they didn't want to work 12-hour, 6-day-a-week jobs. They wanted to have, for peanuts, they wanted to have a raise. They wanted to have an 8-hour day. And I wrote the book and then found out that in December, the Carpenters Union had actually won a strike over that very issue. It's like, wow, this is so strange, you know?
Well, now, I noticed we both belong to the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, and we have a wonderful newsletter that comes out, I guess, quarterly, I think every season, and the author of it did a very nice review of your book in that, too. So if anyone's interested in following up and looking at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association quarterly, they can find that online under PNLHA, and if you do some research, there's a lot of information. It's like about a 6-page, looks like 8-page, with a lot of information about unions in Oregon and Vancouver, British Columbia, Washington, a lot of places. So it's really, I was really amazed at how wonderful it was. And he even does some movie reviews, you know, Hoffa's Killer on the big screen. The Irishman. That was a very good movie. But yeah, so there's that. And he also was really impressed with your book, as we all are that know you. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was your recent travels to Spain.
Portugal and Spain.
Portugal and Spain.
And I think what you and I talked about was I have for a long time known about the Mondragon cooperatives.
Which looks like Mondragon.
Yes, it looks like Mondragon, but they pronounce it Mondragon. And it's in northern Spain in the Basque Country. Mondragon is an actual town, and it's up against the Pyrenees. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I had never seen the Basque Country before, and it looks like, I keep telling people, it looks like the Willamette Valley on steroids. Green, 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 small farms. It's really beautiful. Lots of mountains. Anyway, we had the experience of first going to Guernica. And Guernica is the place where the Nazis were given permission by Franco to bomb the town of Guernica, which was the heart of the Basque independence movement. And they came in and carpet bombed for something like 8 hours. And the rats, they picked the market day when all the people from all the surrounding town would be there. So they killed a lot of people, like 900 or something. Anyway, so we went to that one day, and the next day we go to Mondragon. And it's like we were in this range from the worst humanity can do to the best. Because the Mondragon cooperatives are worker-owned and worker-run, and they've existed since 1949. They were started by a Basque Catholic priest, and they are the second largest corporation or organization in Spain. They've made northern Spain the industrial heart of Spain, and the most well-to-do part of Spain. the town of Mondragon itself is half the people who live there work in the cooperatives. They have a university, they have a hospital, they have a bank, and we were fortunate enough that one of the directors there took us around and talked to us. And he basically said that the only way you can be fired is if you steal or you are violent against a co-worker. Otherwise, you have a job for life, and they will do everything they can to make you successful.
So it's a not-for-profit kind of place.
No, it makes a profit.
And what do they do with the profits?
They plow it back into the organization.
And the organization is basically for the people that work there?
Yes.
That's what a collective is?
Yes. And they have the highest wages, the best benefits, the best pension.
Very nice.
Of all of Spain, probably yes. Of all of Europe, I don't know.
Could be. Well, I thought that was a really interesting aside to your travels.
Yes, it was wonderful.
Okay. So we can look forward to another book coming up soon, maybe a year or so.
Yes.
Take you a while, right?
Yes, this one.
Even as fast as you work. So thank you very much for sharing your book with us and Mondragon, or Mondragon, if you want to know the spelling. And we'll see you next time around.
This is
Lane Ponce closing out for Labor Radio, Fifth Monday. Thank you for joining us. Tune in every Monday, 6 to 6:30, Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Please, Mr. Redman, don't put me out in the street.
The Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There is a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608. Rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and/or lease non-renewal notices. Phone number is 5-